there are not enough female negotiators out there. And having been the chief negotiator for Canada, I've heard, and I think this is true, that maybe one third of the chief negotiators are women. It's just not enough.
Hello and welcome back to the Climate Bridge podcast. My name is Toby Bernstein and I am a consultant at the Berlin-based think tank Adelphi, where I co-lead the program office of the Transatlantic Climate Bridge, the initiative behind this podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome. I'm Luisa Kern and I'm a member of the young grassroots think tank Polis 180, which works on making European and foreign policy more accessible for young people. We are one of Adelphi's partners, and I will be co-hosting this podcast.
The goal of the Transatlantic Climate Bridge and of this podcast is to promote climate cooperation between Germany, the US, and Canada. Today, we have a very special podcast episode for you, which we recorded live from this year's Transatlantic Climate Bridge conference. If you want to find out more about the Transatlantic Climate Bridge, stay tuned through the end of the episode. But for now, let's dive right into our interview. Our guest today is Catherine Stewart. Catherine is the Assistant Deputy Minister for International Affairs at Environment and Climate Change Canada. She previously has held the position of Chief Negotiator for Climate Change and Director General in the Multilateral Affairs and Climate Change Directorate, also in the ECCC. In her current role, she oversees all bilateral and trilateral climate negotiations and has played a key role in Canada's international climate diplomacy. Welcome, Catherine.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thanks so much for joining us. All right, let's dive right in. We heard that you've worked over 25 years for the federal Canadian government in the areas of security, defense, and environmental policy, including the Department of National Defense and as the director of the National Fighter Procurement Secretariat. Whereas in the last decade, you have focused your career on international climate policy, most recently, as we mentioned, as Canada's lead climate change negotiator. So how did you come to focus on international climate policy? And how, would you say, are these areas interconnected?
Yes, I've spent 25 years working in Canada's federal government. And I do have quite an interesting background, having worked in defense and security at the first part of my career. And I think it just illustrates what an interesting career you can have in federal government. I never saw myself in a lot of the jobs that I had. But, you know, I think many of the skills are very transferable from one department to another. I supported the Minister of National Defense in NATO ministerial meetings, for example, and supported him in bilateral meetings. And now here I am, you know, 20 years later, supporting the Minister of the Environment and Climate Change in bilateral meetings and multilateral meetings. So a lot of the skill sets are very transferable. And absolutely, there's a lot of interconnectedness between policies across government. And I have to say, when I first joined government and worked in defense, I mean, there was very little discussion about climate change in that space. And it's interesting to observe now how the discussions have evolved in the defense and security field, as an example. And just last week, the Prime Minister announced that Montreal in Canada would be the host country for a NATO climate change and security center of excellence, for example, which will be a platform to bring together military and civilians to develop an enhanced knowledge and share knowledge on climate change security impacts. So it's come quite a ways over the past decades. And that's just one example, but I think the interconnectedness goes everywhere. Like we have lots of interconnectedness between climate change and nature, oceans, health, and so on. And so this space has become much fuller, much busier over time.
Thanks. That's fascinating. I'd like to move on to talk about Canadian climate policy more broadly. So Canada announced its commitment to its national climate plan, the Pan-Canadian Framework, in 2016, And more recently, the Canadian government introduced the Clean Air Strong Economy Plan in March of this year, which provides a roadmap for the Canadian economy to achieve 40 to 45% emissions reductions below 2005 levels by 2030. So I'd like to ask you, what role do Canada's provinces and territories play in its green transition? And does the fact that Canada has a federal system render it better suited to devising a comprehensive national climate plan, or can this pose its own challenges?
Thanks. I think that's a great question. And when it comes to tackling climate change, you know, cooperation between all levels of government is essential. And I think especially this is the case in Canada, where the environment is an area of shared jurisdiction between the federal government and provinces and territories. And there's no one-size-fits-all approach for reducing greenhouse gas emissions across Canada, given the unique circumstances of each region across our country. So respect for that shared jurisdiction on all matters related to the environment is really fundamental to Canada's approach to engagement on these issues. And you talked about the Pan-Canadian framework adopted in 2016. That was very much a collaborative effort between provinces and territories on climate change. And it really set and raised the bar in terms of that level of cooperation, so that when we continued to introduce the 2030 emissions reduction plan recently, it also lays out how the federal government will work with provinces and territories in key areas, such as reducing emissions from the oil and gas sector and further greening Canada's homes and electricity grid. So coordination between provinces, territories, and the federal government has also not been without its challenges. But overall, the federal system has its strengths in that the federal government sets the policy direction, which then enables the provincial and territory governments to put in place complementary measures. And I think carbon pricing is an example of this, right, where you know, it allows different pricing systems to be put in place across our country and for provinces and territories to look at different approaches, including like cap and trade, but yet with common national stringency requirements. So that's one example of how the federal government set that direction and enables provinces and territories to establish their own approaches. But we also bring this level of cooperation, collaboration to the international space. And so while we lead as a federal government engagement on climate change internationally, we do place a priority on ensuring that our provinces and territories are represented in our approach to multilateral meetings. An example of this is, for example, at the UNFCCC COPs. We bring representatives from the provinces and territories with us on our negotiations so that we can develop common positions together or have a good common understanding of where we're going together. So I think that's one example of cooperation on the international side as well.
Thank you very much. That was very interesting. I'd now like to sort of turn towards the multilateral stage, if that's okay. So you have worked at several multilateral fora and you have been to 5 COPs representing Canada, and at 3 of which you were Canada's chief climate negotiator, so COP 23, 24, and 25. And we would like to know if you could tell us a little bit more about what defines Canada on the international stage in relation to climate diplomacy. So, for instance, what is Canada particularly well situated to do in the climate diplomacy landscape? And where do you see room of improvement, for instance, in comparison to other countries?
For sure. And I think to respond to your question, I'll build on the last comment I made about Canada bringing representatives from the provinces and territories to COP. In a similar manner, our representation at the UN Climate Conference, the COPs, is very much focused on diversity and inclusion. So not only do we bring provinces and territories with us, we bring a very inclusive delegation, which includes youth representatives. It includes representatives from civil society, labor groups, businesses. We bring opposition members of parliament, And of course, our representatives from our national Indigenous organizations, among others. So that kind of is a reflection of Canada's approach to climate change. And that's how we also projected internationally through just by virtue of the people we bring on our delegation to COP. In addition, I would say our approach to climate diplomacy is very much anchored in projecting our domestic successes and approaches abroad. For example, our experience on coal phase out and in implementing our carbon pricing system, which I mentioned. But similarly, Canada has leveraged our efforts towards Indigenous reconciliation at home into an active role through the creation of the Local Communities and Indigenous Peoples Platform under the UNFCCC, which really is a truly unique platform under the UN system. And I think, for example, we need to work on the synergies between the UNFCCC and other intergovernmental processes, including the work that's being done on aviation and maritime transport. So I think, and I talked earlier about the interconnected nature of climate change with nature, with oceans. So I think there's so much more we can do in this space and that we need to do.
Thank you so much. I think you've just highlighted the benefits and the importance of diversity and inclusion. And I'd actually be interested in her hearing a little bit more about this, because Canada has done some very interesting work to bring the more unheard voices to the table in the international climate movement. And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about some of these initiatives and walk us through the challenges you have encountered along the way and how you work to overcome them. And personally, I would really like to hear more about the training you've done for female climate negotiators.
Great. Happy to speak about that. So I think I can start with the work that we've been doing on gender equality, because, you know, we know that women are increasingly being seen as more vulnerable than men to the impacts of climate change because they represent the majority of the world's poor, but are also proportionately more dependent on threatened natural resources. And worldwide, women have less access than men to resources such as land, such as credit, agricultural inputs, decision-making structures, technology, and so on. So the work that we do internationally to support women and gender equality can be seen in many different ways. I would point to Canada's climate finance commitment. Last year, Canada doubled its climate finance to $5.3 billion over 5 years to support developing country in their mitigation and adaptation efforts. And with that commitment, we also have committed to ensure that 80% of the projects that we do under this $5.3 billion commitment properly integrate gender equality in line with our foreign international assistance policy. So that's one way that we try to ensure more women's voices are heard. The other way is something we've been doing over the past few years and that you mentioned, Louisa, that's the training for female climate negotiators. And what we've been doing is bringing women in developing countries together and teaching them about negotiating. Like, there are not enough female negotiators out there. And having been the chief negotiator for Canada, I've heard, and I think this is true, that maybe one third of the chief negotiators are women. It's just not enough. So the training that we've been doing has really helped to develop that skill in developing countries and empower women to go to the microphone and speak up and advocate for their needs and for their particular situation. So we've done that training over the past several years. And in addition to that, we actually fund for women to go to COP, to participate in COP and put that training into practice. So it's an initiative that I'm particularly proud of because I think it's made a difference, very tangible difference, in a space where we clearly need more women's voices. But I also want to highlight that we've played a leadership role in ensuring the engagement of Indigenous peoples under the UNFCCC, including by advancing this local communities and Indigenous peoples platform. And we consult with our national Indigenous representatives on proposed plans and priorities and activities under this platform, and also have financially supported the establishment at the UNFCCC of an Indigenous Peoples focal point. So again, like another effort we're doing to support these unheard voices within the UNFCCC system.
Thank you for speaking about uplifting underrepresented voices. We're wondering, what are the most empowering ways to do this while avoiding tokenism or speaking for people rather than listening to their voices?
Oh, it's such a great question. And this is why I have found it to be really important when we go to the UN Climate Change Conference, the COPs, to go with a representative delegation, to go with representatives from our national Indigenous organizations, to go with youth representatives, because I feel it's important that those voices are out there and those voices are heard. And I think that also gives youth, for example, these opportunities to find platforms, to find side events, opportunities where they can speak for themselves about the challenges that they face and some of the initiatives that they've taken or solutions that they have to the climate crisis. And I think that's just such a great question, because I think that's why we need more people involved in climate change internationally, because we need those voices. And absolutely, I can't speak on behalf of these voices. And so that's why it's important for us to bring them with us. And it's important for us to consult and help set priorities together and positions together. Because that gives me more legitimacy in what I do.
It's really amazing that you're taking all of this into account. I'd like now to move beyond your responsibilities at the COPs. Canada is currently engaged in over 100 international environmental agreements, be they bilateral or multilateral, and there's also been increasing ambition among governments worldwide, resulting in a mushrooming of international pledges and initiatives. What are the global initiatives that Canada is most focused on? And can you tell us about some of the climate agreements that you're engaged in? And are there any that you'd like to highlight?
Sure. And there's a lot I could say, and we could take hours talking about this. But I think one thing I'd like to highlight for you, given the German connection here. So there are lots of different global initiatives, but I'd like to highlight the work that we've been doing with Germany on the climate finance delivery plan. So last year, Canada joined forces with Germany in developing this plan, which, and just to back up a bit, in 2009, developed countries made a commitment to mobilize $100 billion for developing countries per year to support them in their mitigation and adaptation efforts. And in Paris in 2015, we confirmed that commitment through to 2025. So last year at COP, it was felt that it was very important to demonstrate to developing countries our commitment to meeting that $100 billion goal. We will not meet that goal, unfortunately, in 2020. But with the work we were able to do with Germany last year, we were able to predict that we will reach that $100 billion goal in 2023 and from there on forward. So by doing this work, by reaching out to other donor partners and learning about their climate finance commitments, working with the OECD, we were able to produce this plan, which clearly demonstrated the $100 billion commitment and when it would be made. So in an effort to build trust and confidence among all parties at the UNFCCC. We will be working on a progress report with Germany this year as kind of an update to that report last year, and looking to showcase what some developed countries have been doing in order to continue to meet the needs of developing countries, including, you know, how we are enhancing our contribution toward adaptation, towards doubling adaptation, working with the multilateral development banks and leveraging private sector financing, and so on. So this has been really important work. It's high on my radar this year as we head into COP27 in order to continue to build goodwill and trust and confidence among all parties around the table. And I guess turning to the bilateral arena, again, here there is so much that I could talk about. With every free trade agreement, for example, we have environmental cooperation agreements. So we have a free trade agreement with Chile, for example. We have an environmental cooperation agreement with Chile, where we do lots of really interesting environmental projects. I could talk about work that we're doing with the U.S. as our major trading partner, and given our close economies, there's a lot of important climate work that we're advancing with them, including under a high-level dialogue. So much I could talk about, but I think what I would like to highlight for you is something called the Commission for Environmental Cooperation, which is established under the Canada-U.S.-Mexico Free Trade Agreement. There's similarly, there's an environmental cooperation agreement that goes with that.
It's really interesting to hear that Canada is pursuing environmental cooperation on so many fronts. Perhaps we switch now to the G7, another space ripe for environmental cooperation. So climate and energy were already at the top of the agenda before the Russian invasion and have only become more important afterwards. What would you say are the biggest climate and energy outcomes, and what are the next steps for them?
So we were very grateful to Germany and continue to be grateful to Germany for their leadership of the G7 this year. And I think, you know, we've done quite a bit together as G7 partners to advance ambitious and constructive outcomes for the G7 this year. And I think we were pleased to support a number of outcomes to help advance our collective efforts on climate change and support the energy transition. And I'll name just a few that are quite notable. I think the first one is that commitment to end new direct public support for international unabated fossil fuel energy by the end of 2022. And this builds on a commitment that Canada made at COP26, and recognizing that this commitment remains important, notwithstanding the changing geopolitical circumstances we find ourselves in since COP26 in Glasgow. The other commitment I would highlight is to decarbonize the transportation sector, including the road sector and international aviation and shipping. I'd say thirdly, and I've spoken about this already, is that climate finance commitment and the commitment that the G7 partners made to intensify our efforts on the collective $100 billion climate finance goal and double that provision of climate finance towards adaptation, which is a really important area, as I mentioned, that Canada has been championing with Germany. And of course, the establishment of a climate club to support the effective implementation of the Paris Agreement. And just last week, G7 leaders met and tasked the ministers with more work on the carbon club to come up with the terms of reference by the end of this year. And we're really looking forward to working on that. As I mentioned, carbon pricing is a key part of Canada's climate plan. And we feel the discussion to, you know, we feel the real need to enhance discussions globally on carbon pricing. Ending unabated coal is also, we see, the single most effective step the world must take to meet the Paris climate goals. And the G7 making a commitment there is very significant step. And then I think lastly on just transition, just a small piece there, is part of our climate finance commitment is working to see where we contribute to the Just Energy Transition Partnership, including with countries like South Africa, Indonesia, and Vietnam. So we're hoping that our climate finance contribution can also go towards that goal.
Thank you so much. I'd actually like to stay a little bit on the topic of the G7 and speak about some current challenges. So if you look further eastwards, the so-called West faces multiple challenges right now. in its relations with China, also in its position on Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And the G7 states made clear that they would take a harder stance, for instance, on China and its human rights violations. However, sort of beyond our economic interdependencies, we also really need to work together in the fight against climate change. And we're wondering, how can countries actually keep climate protection a priority while also navigating other very difficult and sometimes even hostile geopolitical tensions?
That's an excellent question. And maybe I'll just begin with Ukraine. And, you know, this is something that Canada fundamentally opposes, the illegal invasion of the Ukraine by Russia. And we recognize the challenges that this has presented to many European partners in their need, urgent need, to reduce their dependency on Russian oil and gas. And Canada has been helping to find interim solutions in terms of energy supply. But I'm pleased to note that with this comes a strong continued commitment for us to keep working toward our net zero by 2050 goals. So I think there's some broad recognition between Canada and European partners that this urgency emboldens us to address energy security, but at the same time address the other crisis of climate change, which is still out there. With regard to China, Canada's approach to China has very much been based on international rules, Canadian values, and results for Canadians. And the environment remains an area where we can continue to have pragmatic cooperation between Canada and China. These global environmental problems require global solutions. And that's why it's important for us to continue to strengthen our partnerships on climate, on environmental protection and conservation with major players. So the challenges on climate change and ocean pollution cannot be effectively addressed without China's contribution to it due to its size and population and carbon-intensive economy. They're the world's largest emitter of GHG emissions with 27% in 2019. So we have to be working with them. And so we've engaged with China more recently with the EU through what's called the Ministerial on Climate Action. And this brings together, under the leadership of Canada, the EU, and China, we co-host a annual ministerial. We bring together about 35 ministers from around the globe representing developed and developing countries in order to help continue to drive climate ambition. A lot of it over the last few years has been on getting the rule book under the Paris Agreement solidified. But now the emphasis has shifted more to implementation and making sure that countries are on track to implement the targets and commitments that they've made. So this has been a really useful forum for us to engage with China, engage with other developing countries and developed countries to continue to try to push and move the needle forward on climate action.
Thank you, Catherine, for all these excellent insights. I'd like to now wrap up with a more lighthearted question. Would you say you are a climate optimist or a climate pessimist? And do you have a motivational quote of the day that you would like to leave people with?
So I wouldn't be able to do my job unless I was a climate optimist. And I've seen a lot of progress that we've been able to do on the international stage. And it's encouraging. It's a lot of hard work when you're working in a multilateral setting to move the needle forward. But I think we need to continue to do that. And I'm very committed to do that with my team. The quote that I would leave you with is from Dr. Jane Goodall. And she said, "What you do makes a difference. And you have to decide what kind of difference you want to make." I've always really liked that quote and sharing that with you today.
Thank you again.
Well, thank you, Louisa and Toby, for this opportunity. It was really a delight to speak with you both today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much from my side as well for both your insightful answers and all the nice insights into Canadian climate diplomacy. And now for one of our segments, there's a German word for that. We know English speakers love long German compound words, so we want to dig into one each episode. Luisa, what is today's word? What does it mean? And how is it relevant to German climate policy?
So today's word is Treibhausgasminderungsziele, which translates to greenhouse gas reduction targets. It refers to goals made binding by the German climate protection law, that total emissions should be lowered by 65% by 2030 compared to 1990 levels. There are then specific goals for the different sectors, such as building or transport sectors. Unfortunately, it looks like Germany is not on track to reach these goals according to the current projections.
Oh no. Well, I guess it's better to aim high and be ambitious, and hopefully Germany can increase its efforts in the coming years to get themselves back on track.
And now for our final, and personally my favorite segment, the climate policy crush. Catherine, is there climate policy abroad, either in Germany or elsewhere, that you would like to see implemented in Canada?
I love this part of your program, and thanks for asking. You know, it's just important to acknowledge the successes of each other's countries and what works and what doesn't. And I think, you know, we can't also adapt certain policies to our own unique circumstances, just given we're all so different. But I have to say, I was an exchange student in Germany in my teenage years, and I always appreciated Germany's approach to transportation, and more the consumer approach to transportation. Like, everybody in Germany uses public transit in one way or the other. And it's just a given. You take the train somewhere rather than your car. And the systems there are so advanced, and they are everywhere. And I admire that a lot in about Germany. And even going back, you know, decades later, the emphasis on public use of public transportation is still very much there. And just the public consumption of your transportation systems is so impressive. And Canada's working on it. We have different realities, much bigger country, much bigger infrastructure to have to deal with. But I've always really admired that about Germany, and just traveling in Europe in general, is that public transit really is an option basically no matter where you are. So kudos to my European colleagues.
Thanks a lot, Catherine. Yeah, actually, right now, Germany even has the so-called 9 euro ticket, which the government put in place as a subsidy to help with rising costs, allowing you to take any regional and local public transport in the whole country for just 9 euros a month. What about you, Luisa? Do you have a climate policy crush?
I do have a climate policy crush, the Canadian Climate Youth Council. I personally care a lot about meaningful youth participation, which is what Polis 180 is about, and which I've been interested in for quite a while. So the Canadian Environment Ministry established an inaugural Youth Council in 2021, which is supposed to engage on Canada's climate priorities and give input in Canada's environmental policy. I believe this could be a great model for other countries and also for other ministries. Young people need to be at the table, especially when decisions are made that will affect them the most. I have high hopes for such projects and hope they will be rolled out on a broad basis.
If you're still listening, I'm sure you want to learn more about the Transatlantic Climate Bridge. Adelphi and its partners run the TCB with the support of our funders in the German federal government, and our activities include writing analysis, putting on events, facilitating government dialogue, organizing exchange programs, and much more. To find out more, please visit our website, theclimatebridge.org, and follow us on Twitter at @theclimatebridge. That's it for our third episode. I'm Toby, signing off.
And I'm Luisa. Thanks for listening, und bis zum nächsten Mal.